Okay, you'll have to approve that. Okay. So we are kind of, all of our shiurim up until now in this parak have been more or less of an introduction to the main feature, if you will, or the main issue, which is the conversation between the Isha HaTkuit and David. So we saw that she presents to David this mashal of her story, or the story of the context of her story, her plight, and Yoav had put her up to it, but Yoav had hired her or engaged her to do this. And he actually tells her exactly what to say. And so part of what we're going to have to address is the question of what did Yoav tell her, and what did she, of her own insight, wisdom, chokhmah, intentionally or unintentionally, kind of trigger in David's mind? So that is part of the issue, because at the end of her story, on the one hand, David recognizes, if we jump to the end of the conversation, Pasuk Yud Chet, V'yana melech v'yomer le'isha, he says to her, don't hide anything from me. Hayad Yoav itach. Did Yoav put you up to this? And in every interaction we've had with Yoav, till now with David, if Yoav put her up to it, that's clearly not a good thing, right? That's not an indication of something which David would take positively to. And yet the moment she says yes, David still agrees. And he turns to Yoav and he says, Lech Hashem et anarat Avshalom. So whatever she's told him, on the one hand, has given given away Yoav's hand in all of this, and at the same time, still convinced David to go and follow the plan of bringing back Avshalom and allowing Yoav to do so. And then Yoav goes, he has this interaction, which we talked about last week, where he says, thank you for listening to me. And then he brings back Avshalom. And the moment Avshalom returns, David says, okay, you're banished to your house. You can't step foot in the palace. I don't want to see you. And of course, that raises the whole question of why bring him back if you don't want to see him. What's going on? So more or less, we've asked a lot of questions. And now we need to kind of delve into the core of the story, which is not her story, not her plight, right? It's not about what she tells David in the initial part of her presentation, right? When she talks about having two sons and they're in the field and they were hitting each other, were fighting with each other, and one killed the other, and now the family wants to come and wants to kill the perpetrator as the remaining child, but she's also a widow. So essentially, if he dies by the hands of the blood avengers, she will lose everything, and the inheritance will go to the person who killed her remaining son. And by the end of this conversation, David has promised him protection, kind of a full royal pardon. On the face of it, I don't think David would have connected his story to her story, because the stories really are so dramatically different. And I think we highlighted those differences when we first went through the story. There is a, sorry. The differences between the two, right? She's a widow. She has only two sons. One son killed the other. There's literally nobody left in the family except this one remaining child. David is David HaMelech. He's got multiple wives. He has multiple children. Even if Avshalom killed Amnon, we're not talking about the end of the family lineage. We're not talking about the end of the family line of the inheritance. We're not talking about two brothers who, right, in her case, the two brothers who happened to be fighting in the field, and one came and the fight got out of hand and one killed the other. David's case was premeditated. I think the most dramatic difference between them is that in her case, if David pardons her son in order to protect him, I don't think there are any lasting consequences to that act. Right? There's no political fallout. There's no political, those lasting consequences. It's an isolated personal family challenge. In David's case, if he brings back Avshalom and pardons him, we're dealing with an act of treason, right? The Avshalom is guilty of an act of treason. He's killed the crown prince. To pardon somebody who's committed treason against the crown is a much more delicate political decision. And so for David to take the takeaway from the story of this woman and her two sons and to apply it to his own situation on his own, I don't think David would have possibly connected those two dots. On the other hand, she spells it out for him. She says to him, how can you let your son remain in exile? Vatomer Aisha, Vatadaberna Shivchatcha L'Adoni HaMelech Davar, my king, if it please you, I have something I need to say. Vayomer Taber, so he says, speak. Vatomer Aisha, V'lama chashavta kazot al am Elokim? Why would you think such a thing about the people of God? Umidaber hamelech hadavar hazeh ka'asher. In speaking this, the word of the king is this word of the king. The king, for in speaking this word, the king is as one that is guilty. In other words, by pardoning my son, you do so, and you, in a sense, you indict yourself. Why? Because you do not bring or return the one who is banished, right? The king's banished one, which is of course a reference to Avshalom, is sitting in exile. You're willing to pardon my son, but you're not willing to bring back Avshalom. Yimot namut, v'chamayim enigavim arza, we must die like water spilled on the ground, ashelo yasefer, which cannot be gathered up again, v'lo yisar l'kim nefesh, and God does not favor any soul. Unclear in any context what she's referring to. But then she says, v'chashav machashavot levilti yidach memen lidach. Let him devise a means that he that is banished should not be banished, or he that is an outcast should not be an outcast. The reason I have come to speak to the king for this, Yiruni ha'am, the people have made me afraid. Your maidservant said, I will speak to the king. Maybe the king will listen to me. The king will certainly hear and deliver me, meaning his servant, referring to herself, out of the hands of the man that would destroy my son and me and my son from the inheritance of God. Let the word of my lord, the king, be as a source of comfort, for he is like an angel of God. So is my lord, the king, to discern good and bad. May Hashem be with you. The phraseology here, the grammar here, the articulate clarity with which she describes her own plight completely breaks down. These are sentences that are kind of, from a grammar perspective, phrases that are put together that almost make no sense. But one thing is clear. What she's driving here is a request to do what? At the bottom line of it, what's her request?
To let Avshalom come back.
And how do we know that that's her request? Where does she say it? She says a lot of things. But where does she actually make the request to bring back Avshalom? It's hard to see the whole context here. Actually, let me show it to you here. Okay? It'll be a little easier to see. without the Hebrew, or the English is over here. But there is essentially two places where she makes direct reference to bringing back the one who has been banished. The king speaks this as if the king is guilty, because he has refused to bring back the one who has been banished, his banished one. And therefore, whatever this introduction is, we must die and like water spilled on the ground. But let him devise a means that he that is banished shall not be banished. The rest of it is almost reads as mumble jumble. We'll make sense of it more or less eventually, probably next week. But for now, I want to focus on these two phrases. She's clearly referenced Avshalom. She's clearly referenced one who has been banished. And in David's household, there's only one who has been banished, namely Avshalom. And she talks about returning him, Hashiv HaMelech Et Nidcho. So clearly she is talking about bringing Avshalom home. And if you're willing to pardon my son, you're willing to pardon the one who has been banished from the king, talking in third person, meaning your son who has been banished. Now, as I said at the beginning, from a logical standpoint, her story and this request have virtually nothing in common. Because everything about her story is personal. Everything about her story is a tragedy of a humanitarian tragedy. Everything about Avshalom is national and is political. There's nothing humanitarian in the story of Avshalom's banishment. He's been guilty of murder and regicide, and he's been exiled, right? And that's where the story stops. And yet she makes a plea. And clearly the plea resonates with David. The rest of it is far less articulate, and there's no request in the rest of the story, right? There's no request anywhere in this paragraph. She only explains why she's there and why she speaks and why she's, right, the king will deliver my son, so the king will deliver his son, right? It's all part of this broader sort of, she's just talking. And we'll address the question of what she says in this paragraph. But the core of her request is articulated here. The king needs to return his banished one, so that he should not be further banished. To what is she referring, and why suddenly does that resonate with David? Understand, to grant this pardon, to bring back Avshalom, is to grant pardon to somebody who's committed treason. A king has the authority to grant a pardon, but in Jewish law, a king doesn't have unilateral authority to pardon somebody who's guilty of treason against the king. That's very complicated. There's a notion in the Gemara, it's a Gemara in Kiddushin, you have it below in source one. There's a notion of the Gemara that says that the difference between a king and a shofet, or a king and a nasi, we talked about this back in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Shoftim. What makes a nasi different than a king? The nasi is a tribal leader. In the Chumash, a Nasi is called the tribal leader. In post-Chumash, the Nasi role is called a Shofet. We talked about when we did Sefer Shofti. Nasi shemachal al kvodo, kvodo machul. A Nasi can forego their honor. A Nasi doesn't have to stand in ceremony. A Nasi is a Shofet. He's essentially one of the people. Whereas a Melech is not one of the people. A Melech shemachal al kvodo en kvodo machul, a king who forgoes his own honor and his own dignity and wants to be one of the people, doesn't have that right. Why not? Because the Torah says, Som tasim alecha melech. The king has to be an appointment over the people. There has to be a sense of dread or fear or reverence for the king. Shetayim mato alecha. King doesn't have unilateral authority to do whatever he wants, and it certainly doesn't have because the king represents the entire Jewish people. The king represents the nation of Israel, represents the government of Israel. He represents the totality of the Memshalah. The king can't just abdicate that role and say, okay, we're going to grant a pardon to Avshalom, who committed fratricide and regicide, killed his brother, who committed treason. We're just going to embrace him, kiss him, and everybody's going to live kumbaya and live happily ever after. He's in exile because he committed treason.
And what makes King David ask her? Did she see Joab?
Oh, that's next week. We're not going to answer that question today. That's part two. We'll get to that but I want to focus on this. I want to focus on what it is that she says that resonates with David. And really what I want to come back to is the fact that I don't think what she's alluding to, and here I'm going to conjecture a little bit. We're going to stretch this a little bit, but I think it's within the realm of reason. And I don't think she's actually referring here to the question of whether he's committed treason or to the question of whether or not he's been exiled rather than executed for his crime. And both of those are expected given the nature of his crime. And what she is referring to, I think, here specifically is something which will resonate with David more than it will resonate with anybody else. And that's the fact that he's been banished to not the fact that he's been banished, but to where has he been banished? Where is Avshalom? I think that's the key question here. Not that he is not here, but the question of where he is. And if you go back to the end of the previous parak, when Avshalom flees and he runs away, where does he run to? We have Shalom Barach, Vayelech El Talmai Ben Amihud Melech Geshur. He runs to Talmai Ben Amihud, this king of Geshur. Where is Geshur as a machloket? Most Mefarshim say it's up in the area of Aram, Syria, kind of the region. There are some who suggest that it's further south in the area of Edom. But it's clearly in the context of a nation bordering Israel, separate nation, right? Remember the whole story of that we had a whole discussion about Tamar and Amnon and how Amnon was he allowed to potentially marry Tamar? Who was Tamar? Tamar, Avshalom's brother. Tamar was also the daughter of Ma'acha, daughter of Talmai ben Amihud ben Melech Geshur. In other words, Avshalom is the son of Ma'acha, daughter of Talmai Melech Geshur. However that union came about between David and Ma'acha, Talmai is Avshalom's grandfather, which means that Avshalom is now sitting in exile outside of the land of Israel, outside of the realm of Israel, embraced by whom? Embraced by
his grandfather,
king, foreign power, who happens to be his grandfather. Just imagine that for a moment. Just imagine that reunion. Here's the son of King David, right? Foreign power, foreign enemy, foreign nation, for whatever the context is. And this son of David comes running to his grandfather for asylum because whatever the family conflict was, right? In protection, remember the context, in protection of the dignity of his sister, who also is Talmai's granddaughter. Can you imagine that reunion? Would Talmai Melech Geshur embrace Avshalom? Of course he'd embrace Avshalom. Avshalom's a hero. I'm sure he arrived in Eretz Geshur with a parade. And the hero who protected the dignity of, who stood up for the dignity of his of the princess of Geshur. And ultimately, I think that plays into the question, where, not of the fact that he is exiled, but to where is he exiled? The fact that Avshalom is now for 3 years sitting in the area of Eretz Geshur, outside of the domain of the land of Israel, embraced by this foreign king. To David, I think that moment, that recognition where she plays that card and says, your son has been exiled to Chutz La'aretz, has been exiled to outside of the land of Israel, that's a card that resonates with David differently than it would resonate with anybody else. Why? So to understand why we need to go back to David's early years, you could take a step back all the way, turn the clock back from rewind all of Shmuel Bet back to the end of Shmuel Aleph. And what we find in the end of Shmuel Aleph in Perek Chavav is the following story. This is in the midst of area of Ziv. This is in the midst of the time when Shaul is chasing after David, when Shaul thinks that David is committed, is after him and trying to kill him. David is on the run, and David is hiding in the mountains of Eretz of Midbar Yehuda. And there are two places, one in Perek Chav Dalet and one's here, where David finds himself in a position where Shaul is vulnerable to attack. And David is challenged by his own people to attack Shaul as a kind of act of self-defense, meaning he's a rodef, he's chasing you, he's trying to kill you, you have an opportunity to take him out while he's sleeping or in the cave or whatever the circumstances are. And David refuses to do it. I remember it's one of the first times we encountered the intensity of the conflict between David and the sons of Tzruya. This second case is where Shaul is out on the field and in the middle of the night and sleeping, and David goes down to engage with him. He takes with him Abishai ben Tzruya. And I'm just going to jump to the end of the story. And Abishai says to him, Sigar alakim ayomet oyivcha biyadecha, God has delivered your enemy into your hands this day. Right. With one swoop, I can spear him through the head and through the earth and kill him. And David looks at Abishai and he says, what are you going to destroy the Mashiach, the anointed one of God? And he says, no, refuses to let him do so. And instead he takes his Shaul's spear and he takes Shaul's water and he steals them as if to demonstrate that Shaul was vulnerable. He wants to prove to David to Shaul that David had no intention of killing. So he takes his chanit, he takes his tzapachat, this spear and cruse of water, and then from afar he comes back to his camp and he calls out and he stands at the top of the mountain, merachok, and he calls to Shaul and he says, "Vayikra David al ha'am el Avner," and he says to him, "Avner ben Ner." I'm there. You're supposed to protect the king. Here I was. Here's the king's sword and the king's spear and the king's water. It's in my hands because I was literally standing next to the king and you were sleeping. Falling asleep during a watch and military watch is actually a death sentence. All right. Vayakir Shaul, it's called David. Shaul recognizes David's voice. Vayomer Akochazeb Beni David, is that your son? Is that you? Is that you, my son? Is that your voice? And David says yes. And he says, why are you chasing me? I could have killed you. I didn't. Clearly, I have no intention of harming you. And then we get to pasuk yutet. V'yatay yishmana Adoni Amelach Tivrei Avdo. Let the Lord, the King, hear the words of his servant. I have. I want to get this off my chest. If it is God who has set you against me, offer a sacrifice, an appeasement, something. And if it is people who have set me up and have told you that I am guilty of treason, let them be cursed. Meaning, I have done nothing to harm you. But my situation, my plight has been, ki gershuni hayom istapech benachalat Hashem lemor lechavod alehim acherim. But I have been cursed by being driven out this day from the inheritance of God, from the land of Israel, the land of God, saying, go serve other gods. So we'll come back to this last phrase in a second. Has David been exiled from the land of Israel? David, in his flight, his plight of flight, in his flight from Shaul, has David been exiled from the land of Israel?
Yes.
Yes. When? Where? To whom? Twice, actually. Three times, really, if you technically look at it. Think about the land of Israel, not from the perspective, this is what Doc points out, think of the land of Israel, not from the perspective of, where's the Doc? I lost that for a second. Where did I go? Here. Not from the perspective of the geography of the land, because he's not leaving Eretz Yehuda, but rather from the fact that he's going, in order to escape from Shaul, he's had to run into the domain of Achish Melech Gat. Eretz Plishtim is technically part of still the land of Israel, but not part of the government of Israel. It's a separate country. It's a separate region. It's under the domain of Achish. He's also been forced to run to Moab. If you remember when he first left after the murder of the people of Nov, he was forced to go and hide his family under the protection of the king of Moab. Unfortunately, that did not end well. So twice David, and he goes back to God twice, so it's really three times, David has been forced to go into a foreign region, a foreign power under the protection of a foreign king in order to be protected from Shaul's wrath, from Shaul's chase. He calls that Yeshuni Ayom Yistapech Banachalat Hashem. I have been driven this day from staying, from clinging, from the inheritance of God. I have been exiled, banished from this land. So when she says to David that your child has been banished, nidcho, it's much more than just the fact that he's been sent into a exile, into a a near miklat. He's been exiled from the land of Israel, from the domain of the kingdom of Israel. That's the story of David. That's exactly what happened to David. That resonates with David. But it goes even further, because then David adds this odd, almost spiritual dimension to what it means to be exiled from the inheritance of God, from the land of Israel, describing it as Lech Avod Elohim Achrim, go serve other gods. What's that about? And that's the core of the issue. Let me show you a Gemara. Gemara says the following. It's really an astounding Gemara, and it really places in perspective this whole discussion. Gemara in Ksubas Daf Kuf Yud. Tanu Rabbanan, a rabbi's taught. Lelam Yado Adam Be'eretz Yisrael Lafir Be'ir Shiru Be'goyim. A person should always live in the land of Israel, even in a city inhabited by majority of Gentiles. One version of the Gemara says Akum. Ve'al Yado B'chutz Aretz Vafilu Be'ir Shiru by Yisrael. And not reside outside of the land of Israel, even in a city that is majority of Jews. Why not? Shekol Adar Be'eretz Yisrael Domek K'mishi Yesh Lo Allah. Because anyone who lives in the land of Israel is as if they have a God. And if you live in outside of the land of Israel, it's as if you don't have a God. As it says, God is connected to the land of Israel. That's quite an astounding statement. But then the Gemara says, wait a second, how could you say that? Anybody who doesn't live in the land of Israel doesn't have a God? That's astounding. That's ridiculous. So the Gemara softens it. Okay, I'll buy that. We're going to change it up a bit. We're going to change it to the following. It's anybody who lives outside of the land of Israel. It's as if they worship idols. That better? What's the proof? The proof is by David. It says, "Ki gershuni ayom mistapech b'nachalat Hashem lemor lech avod elohim acharim." I have been exiled this day to go outside of the inheritance of God, saying, because I've been exiled to a foreign land or a foreign government or a foreign country, go and worship other gods. Nobody's telling David to go and worship idols. Rather, since he was leaving the domain of the land of Israel, it's as if he worshiped idols. Now, I just want to make one observation here. David wasn't going outside of the geographic boundary of the land of Israel. David was going outside of the political boundary of the kingdom of Israel. That's what the Gemara is referring to here. And yet it's referred to as worshiping idols. Why? That's quite an astounding statement. So to put this in perspective, and I think we need to understand what exactly is all of this referring to. What is she playing when she says the words of Oti Yidach Mimenu Lidach? What is David saying to Shaul when he says to Shaul, if you exile me today from the land of Israel, from the kingdom of Israel, I'm going to be as if I'm worshiping idols, banished. What's playing on the heartstrings of David? So, to put it in perspective, I think we need to understand the difference between the world we live in today and the world that we are addressing in the context of the world of Tanakh. We live in a world today, it's very hard for us to get our heads around the fact that we live in a world today where communication is so ubiquitous. Look what we're doing here, right? I'm sitting here in St. Louis, and people in Toronto, people in Calgary, in the morning I have people in Israel, and we're all having a conversation about a parak in Tanakh. Boundaries mean virtually nothing anymore. Geographic boundaries, political boundaries. Yes, of course, in the land of Israel, there's a certain spiritual intensity that comes to the fact that there's so many more Jews and so many more opportunities, and et cetera. But at the end of the day, boundaries in today's world mean much less than they did even a century ago. Imagine for a moment 3 millennia ago, where there's no electricity, no communication, there's not even newspapers. What do you have? You have countries that are identified with a religion and a culture and a covenant and a God. And so the Jewish people are in the land of Israel. That's where they live. And if you're in the land of Israel, you're identified with the people of Israel and the Jewish people and the Torah people of Israel and the God of Israel. If you are living outside of that land, imagine for a moment you're Avshalom and now you're living in Eretz Geshur. Okay, so tell me, where are you going to find a shul in Eretz Geshur? Where are you going to find a minyan in Eretz Geshur? Where are you going to put a tefillin in Eretz Geshur? Where are you going to identify yourself, embraced by a foreign king, living in alone, the only Jew in the entire region? Identification, religious identification, national identification are so interconnected in the world of Tanakh that we sometimes don't realize the impact. What it means that where you live defines your religious, spiritual anchor and who you are and who you identify with. If you're living in Moab, you're identified as a Moabite. If you're living in Geshur, you're identified as a Geshurite. If you're living in Israel, you're identified as an Israelite. That's why the whole issue of conversion in today's world is so different than it is in the world of Tanakh, because geography means so much more intensely in that world. The moment Avshalom is banished outside of the land of Israel and forced to run outside of the cities, remember, we have cities of refuge in the land of Israel for that very reason, so that people in this situation, murderers, etc., have a place to go to without running outside of the land of Israel. Or Avshalom, the moment he's forced into a foreign country or willingly goes to a foreign country, or for David, when he's forced to go to Eretz Gath in that time that he's there, so he figures out some ruse by which he can still remain loyal to the Yeshuvim of Israel in some manner, if you remember the story. But it takes a David and a warrior to be able to hide that and be able to remain that kind of affiliated, but what he says to Shaul is, the moment I go to Chutzlar, it's as if I'm worshiping idols, because I'm serving, or I'm part of a nation that believes in a different God. And that's exactly what we're dealing with. And if we understand this distinction, suddenly there are whole stories of Tanakh, of this division between being somebody individually who is either banished or willingly goes to a different country, and what that means for their identity and their affiliation, suddenly whole other stories come into clarity. Shane, a couple of examples. This is, let's start with Shoftim. Start with the story of Yiftach. Yiftach is a fascinating story into itself. Yiftach, we actually addressed a little bit of the story because when we were talking about the dynamic in the family of Shalom, Acha, Amnon, Tamar, we used the story of Yiftach when we were talking about how do you have situations where a person has two multiple wives with a second wife, where the first wife has no children and then marries the second wife in order to have children, and then the first wife has children, and now you have a conflict between the children of the two wives. Remember that, the whole story, Ben HaBachora, Ben HaSnua? Okay, so Yiftach was that classic example. He was a warrior, lived in the area of the Gilad. Right? The area of the Gilad is more or less a little bit north of the sort of Jordan today, but it goes all the way up into the area of the Golan. So this whole area is what we would call the area of Gilad. He was the son of a zona. She's described here as a prostitute, although the next pasuk describes his mother as a ben isha acheret, another tribe, as the Radak says, probably a second wife. And vayolad Gilad et Yiftach. Batelet eshet Gilad lobanim. In the meantime, Mrs. Gilad had other children. So now Yiftach finds himself with half-brothers, because Gilad had Yiftach and then had other from a second wife or Gilagesh or some other context. And now his main wife had other children. Classic example that we talked about in the previous case with in the Torah. The children of the primary wife grew up. And they turned to Yiftach, they saw Yiftach as a threat. This is exactly the Yerusha conflict that we talked about. But look what happens. Vayigashu et Yiftach. They exiled Yiftach. They drove him out. Vayomulo, and they said to him, Lo tinchal bevet avinu. You will not inherit in our father's house. You will not take a portion in our inheritance. Why? Ki ben isha acheret ata. Because you are the son of the other woman. So they threw him out. Where did they throw? Where did he go? Vayivrach Yiftach mipnei achav, vayeshev be'eretz tov. He went and he lived in the land of Eretz Tov. I'll show you on a map in a moment where Eretz Tov is. Vayitlaktu al Yiftach anashim reikim. And following Yiftach, he gathered around them a whole group of worthless men, worthless, empty, maybe landless, bitter warriors, but they were warriors. And as time moved on and the people of Israel found themselves at war with Ammon, they didn't have anybody to come and save them. So they went and they sent the elders of Gilad to bring Yiftach back from Eretz Tov. And Yiftach says to them, you hated me, atem snetemoti, but the garshuni mi beit avi, you exiled me from my father's house. And you sent me out, and you sent me, and I had to come to here to Eretz Tov. And now you come and ask me to come and help you? Just to put in perspective, where is Eretz Tov? So I'll show you a map. Here's the map. Here's the Gilad. Here's Eretz Tov. Eretz Tov is some... Here's Ammon. Here's Moab. Edom is further south. And this is Eretz Tov. What does that do for us today? Let's look a quick modern map. Superimpose a modern map of Israel on this area. And what do we have? Right, so here's Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Jordan. I think it's part of Iraq, technically. Maybe not. Maybe it's part of Jordan. Right? You understand? But it's certainly part of that region outside of the domain of the land of Israel. And that's the issue with Yiftach. Is now Yiftach goes and he spends years and he grows up essentially an outcast in exile in Eretz Tov. His cultural affiliation, his religious affiliation, his identity has now been forged by this completely foreign arena. And his warriors, his band of people who fight with him, they're completely Gentile. They're not even Jews. And Hashem make him wear from Eretz Tov. And they have no choice, but they go and they bring Yiftach back to lead the battle. And they're going to make Yiftach the leader. But you understand that Yiftach is a double-edged, is a mixed blessing. Because the same Yiftach who leads them into battle and who defeats the enemies of Ammon is the same Yiftach who's going to slaughter 20 or 30,000 Ephraimites because they dared oppose him and challenge him. Right? Yiftach is one of the three civil wars in Israel because they dared to stand up and challenge him. Yiftach is the one who at the end of the battle jumping to the end of the parak, at the end of the battle, Yiftach makes the following proclamation. Vayida Yiftach neder l'Hashem, he makes an oath to God and he says, if God will give me the people into my hands, the first person to walk out of my house, I will offer them as a sacrifice to God. And all the Mefarshim are shocked. How do you make such an oath? Because at the end of the day, who walked out of his house? His daughter. And guess what? He only had one child. So what was he expecting to walk out of his house? So Chazal said he was expecting, what, is his dog? Offer a non-kosher animal on the Mizbeach? Was he expecting his cow or his sheep or his ox to walk out of his house? They don't live in the house. They live in the... What does it mean? There's no question that in Yiftach's mind, his intention was here a human sacrifice to God. It just happens to be his daughter instead of, I don't know, dare I say it, right? His wife or somebody else. Right? But the context here is extraordinary. What was he expecting? But when you understand that Yiftach is culturally an individual who has now grown up in Eretz Tov, he's grown up in a pagan world, an idolatrous world. That's exactly what David said. You send me to Chutz La'aretz, you send me into the region of Avodah Zarah. That's what's going to happen. The context of life there is life of pagan values. So Yiftach comes back, he doesn't even understand the difference. This is a pagan oath. I'll offer whoever person walks out of the doors of my house will be offered to God as a sacrifice. God doesn't want human sacrifices, but the Yiftach's whole frame of reference is pagan. That's what it means to be banished outside of the land of Israel, to be exiled from where the geography of the land of Israel is so directly connected to the cultural affiliation of being identified as part of the Jewish people. That was Yiftach. I'll give you another example. We have exactly the same issue, except that we don't always see it this way because we're kind of missed a big piece of the story. But let's look at the beginning of Sefer of Megillat Rut. There's a famine in the land. And a person from Lechem Yudah went to live in the land of Moab, together with his wife and his two sons. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and his two sons are Machlon and Chilion from Ephrat of Bet Lechem, and they come to stay Moab. V'yamot Elimelech ish Naomi, Elimelech dies, but Tisher hi yushne banea, and all that's left is Naomi and her two sons. The two sons married Moabite wives, v'yisulem nashim Moabiot, Orpa and Rut, and they stayed there for 10 years, and then they died. And all that was left was Naomi and her daughters-in-law. What's going on here? What is going on here? Why is this story begin with the death of Elimelech and the death of Machlon Mechilion? And why does Elimelech and his family go to Moab? Ostensibly, Moab is the last place in the world you're going to run to if there's a famine. Right? If you look at the geography, we're looking at the land of Moab. Here's Moab and here's Beit Lechem Yehuda. Right? Here's Hebron, here's Beit Lechem. So to run from Beit Lechem to Moab is to cross the Jordan River. But if there's a Ra'av, if there's a famine, that means that there's a drought. If there's a drought, you don't run east. If there's a drought, what direction do you run? There's a drought, and you're living in the land of Israel. There's no rain. Where are you going to run to? Where does Abraham run to when there's a drought in the days of Abraham? Where does Yitzchak try to run to when there's a day when there's a drought in the days of Yitzchak? Mayirav Ba'aretz. South to Egypt. Because Egypt doesn't need rain. Right? Egypt doesn't need rain. Egypt has the Nile. So whenever there's a drought in Israel because there's no rain, you run south. You don't run east. If there's no rain in Israel, there's no rain in Moab. Guarantee you. So what's the solution? So why does he run to Moab? Why there there's bread and in Israel there's no bread? And at the end of the Megillah, at the end of the Perek, she returns home because she hears that there's bread in Israel, now that God has finally heard the cries to give them bread. What does that mean? It's not a hunger because of a drought.
Weren't they running away because he was embarrassed because he didn't want to help anyone or something?
So it's such a medrash, but we'll come to that in a second. But first, understand the story. What is the, when there's, if there's a ra'av, if there's a famine, right? The last place in the world you're going to run to is Moab, unless it's not a famine caused by rain. It's a famine caused by war. And if you go back to the story of Sefer Shoftim at this particular moment in history, and we can't, I'm not going to recreate the whole history of it. I looked at this once many years ago. But if you go back to the context of the history, they're dealing with a war with which nation? Ammon and Moab. They're at war with Moab. The reason there's bread in Moab and there's no bread in Israel is because Moab is winning the battle. And if Moab is winning the battle, where does Elimelech and his two sons run to? Stay Moab.
To the winning side.
Right. They go to Moab because there's bread in Moab. But you understand that to leave Israel, especially if you're in a position of leadership, if you're a position of authority, a position of power, to leave Israel in a time of war, imagine for a moment you're sitting in Ukraine and there's no bread in Ukraine because they're in the midst of a war. So you want bread, you go run to Russia. Because there's bread in Russia. Why? Because they're, the context here is you just change sides. Now you understand what Chazal say, Devin, you're correct, but this is exactly why Chazal say that Elimelech is guilty of treason. And Machlon and Chilion are guilty of, well, we'll get to Machlon and Chilion in a second, but Chazal talk about the chait of Elimelech, Shepili Bansha Yisrael, because he sank the hearts of Israel. He didn't sink the hearts of Israel because a leader of the Jewish people turned their backs on them and he didn't give them staka. Caused their hearts to sink because he was a leader of the people of Beit Lechem and he committed treason by running to the side of that they were at war with. Machlon Mechilion says the Gemara were guilty of nitchayvu kleyala makom, guilty of a sin against God. Destruction. Correct. Because they committed treason, because they ran away, because they ran to a foreign land. They ran to Moab now, and they stayed there for 10 years. Now, if they get married there during those 10 years, you understand that when they left, they were younger. And there they got married. They married Moabite women. Why? Because that's what you do. Who else are they going to marry in Eretz Moab? They're going to find the Jewish girl. They're going to find the Shidduch in Eretz Moab. To live in the land of Moab means to live as a Moabite. To live in Eretz Tov means to live as an idolater. To live in Eretz Gat means to live as an idolater. To live in Eretz Geshur means to live as an idolater. That's exactly what the story is. In Tanakh, the geography and the theology are interconnected. You can't separate them.
Even though they're Jewish?
Who's Jewish? Even though who's Jewish?
Who's ever running away?
But the moment they run away, now they become, they start, they're, imagine for a moment, just imagine for a second in your head. If you were literally the only Jew living in Iran, in a time where there's no communication whatsoever with anybody outside of Iran, and you're the only Jew in Iran, how long do you think you're going to stay Jewish? Right? That's exactly the context here.
Yosef did a better job.
Oh, we'll talk about Yosef in a second. Yosef is the great Nes, but Yosef is the exception to prove the rule. And the whole story of the temptation of Yosef, of Eshet Potiphar, was to demonstrate what normally would happen to somebody at the age of 17 who finds himself in a cultural world in which they are exiled from their family. Remember, there's no Jewish people at this point except for the family of Yaakov. And the family of Yaakov is what exiled him. So Yosef finds himself particularly vulnerable because he's sitting out there in Mitzrayim, in the palace, working for Eshet Potiphar, and now he's tempted by Eshet Potiphar. And I mean, there's no connection left between Yosef, who's been sold by his brothers, sold as a slave, sold into to foreign land. By all logic, the brothers don't even go looking for Yosef because they don't have a possible inkling that there's any possibility of surviving. It's one of the reasons why the story of the sale of Yosef was so heinous. Because it was exactly this issue. They didn't just sell him as a slave. They sold him out of the family of Israel. And by every logical rule and every paradigm we have in Tanakh, Yosef should have been lost. That's exactly the story of Eshet Potiphar. In Yosef's case, Chazal are astonished at Yosef's ability to remain loyal to his father's values. And that's what earns him the title, Yosef Atzadik. Nobody else in this arena is called Atzadik. Not even David HaMelech gets that title. Right? Yosef Atzadik, because of all the people in Tanakh, he's the only one who manages somehow to hold on to those dreams of his and hold on to that vision that he'll one day come back.
Yosef had his father's image in front of him.
So that's the Medrash. The Medrash says that Yosef saw in the window an image of his father's face, right? At that critical moment. But what he really is saying to us is exactly what I'm suggesting, which is that there was that moment of crisis for Yosef, and he manages to explicate himself from it and to return from that brink, primarily because he had those dreams that told him he's going to be part of this family of Yaakov. And they anchored him in that world. And he had the divine providence and the Vashemimo, et cetera. He had all of those pieces. And it's easier in the context of the Avot, right? There's 13 Jews in the whole world, right? There's Yaakov and his children. So you understand the context a little bit. But that's exactly the same challenge that we're describing here. It also explains the continuation of the conversation between Ruth and her daughters-in-law. Because when she starts to return home, because she heard that Hashem had given his people bread, basically means the war was over and Israel survived, Israel was victorious, however you want to look at it. So now they leave Moab, and so she begins the journey home. Remember how she's greeted when she returns to Bethlehem? And they all stand there in the wall in shock. Hazot Naomi. They're all in shock, not because she's returned a pauper when she left as a wealthy woman. They're all in shock because she had the audacity to show her face again in Beit Lechem after her husband had committed treason. Just put it in perspective. And Nach to come home with the Moabite in tow. And she says to her daughters-in-law, Lech Nashov, now go back, each one of you, to your mother, to your household. God should be kind to you. You've been kind to me. And they say, no, we're going to go back with you. And she says to them, no, she beseeches them. She says, I have no other children. You're not going to marry anybody. Shov Navnotai, go home. And so, in the end, Orpah agrees. Orpah is the normal one. But look what Ruth responds to Naomi responds to Ruth about Orpah. Vatomer, hine shava yivimtech, your sister-in-law, has returned el ama ve'el Eloheha, to her people and to her gods, because they're so inextricably connected. You return to Ammon, when you return to Moab, you return to the culture of Ammon and culture of Moab and the culture of and the gods of Moab. And she says to Ruth, go home. And what does Ruth say? Al tifki bilozvech l'shum me'achareich l'asher telchi alech v'asher telin yalin amech ami v'lokayech alokay. It's not just an act of conversion. It's understanding the whole context and the dynamic of what it means in the biblical arena to return to the land of Israel. To return to the land of Israel means to live as a Jew. To live in Moab means to live as a Moabite. To live in Tov means to live as a Tovite. And to live in Geshur means to live as a Geshurite. That's exactly the conversation David has with Shaul. I'm being forced out of the land of Israel to go worship other idols and worship idols because I'm being told to go and live amongst a nation that worships idols. Chazal described this in different language. They talk about the same thing. They talk about the notion of Hillel Omer Al Tifosh Min HaTzibur. Don't separate yourself from the community. What does it mean to separate yourself from the community? Chazal said very harsh things about somebody who separates themselves from the community. Tanu Rabbanan b'zman sheYisrael shu'im b'tzar. If Israel is in pain, if Israel is suffering, if Israel is in anguish, and one person separates themselves, upiresh echad mehem, and says, we'll see what they say in a second. Ba'im shnei malachei sharet mitshamivin lo le'adam, two malachim come. The same two malachim that come to a home, person's home on Shabbos, same two malachim that accompany every human being. We talk about them in the song of Shalom Aleichem. U'menichin lo yedehen al rosho, they place their hands on his heads and they say, Ploni zeh shepirashu min hatzibur al yireh b'nechamat tzibur. This person who separated themselves from the community, let him not see the consolation of the community. Bizman shehatzibur shehu b'tzar, if the people are suffering, person cannot say of themselves, I will go home, I will eat, I will drink, I will have peace upon me, because nothing will happen to me. I'm not, that's them, that's over there. But no, if Israel is suffering, then we are suffering. We have to see ourselves as part of Israel. In Mosek, and if he does this, then there's a pasuk that's applied to him, which I'm going to skip for now, that ultimately, this is considered, the Gemara says, is the greatest chet of Chilul Hashem. The notion of Parash Min HaTzibur isn't just the function of, you know, there's a large minion and there's a small minion, I'm going to daven with the breakaway instead of with the large minion. That's not what Parash Min HaTzibur means. Parash Min HaTzibur means a person decides to live not as a Jew when the Jewish people are suffering. So they decide to go and identify themselves as a Gentile or as some other national affiliation or identity, because that way they can save themselves from the plight of the Jewish people. And the Gemara says that's the greatest crime. The Rambam describes somebody as it locks the doors of person to me, locks the doors of tshuva. Right? No alim darkei tshuva bifnei osehem. Parash min hatzibur. Shulchan Aruch says eno ra'eh b'nechamatan. Will never see the salvation or the victory of the Jewish people, because a person who disconnects themselves from the people of Israel at a moment of crisis. That's exactly what Eli Melech did when he ran to Moab. And he does so willingly, is Parash Min HaTzibur. In the case, that's the greatest crime, to literally to turn your back on your people and on God. In the case of Yiftach, in the case of David, in the case of Shalom, well, we'll get to Avshalom in a second. In the case of Yiftach, they weren't doing it willingly, they were forced. But the consequences are the same. Here's an interesting observation. Let's go back to Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Gimel. Avshalom runs away, and he runs to Talmai ben Amihud Melech Geshur. Vayitabel al beno kol hayamim, and David mourned for him all the days. And he was there for 3 years. This phrase, Vayitabel al beno, David mourned for him, most of the Mefarshim interpret this as referring to Amnon. But we suggested that it could also be, and maybe intentionally, could refer to the fact that that's when David begins to mourn for Avshalom. Not just because he killed Amnon, and not just because he ran to exile, but because of where he ran to. Avshalom barach, and he ran to Melech Geshur, v'yitabel al-benu. David begins to mourn for Avshalom, because from his perspective, Avshalom is finished. There's no coming back from Eretz Geshur. You understand? That's the point. There's no coming back from Eretz Geshur. Until Isha Chachamah from Tekoa talks to David and hits a resonating chord with him and says to him, "My dear king, you yourself are guilty. Levilti Ashib HaMelech et Nidcho. This is your banished one. This is Avshalom. You have to figure out some way. God does not favor any soul. Chashav machshavot levilti dach mimenu nidach. Find a way. Let him find some kind of mechanism. But let not the one who has been banished be further banished or further outcast. Levilti dach mimenu nidach." That's exactly what she is referring to. Avshalom is going to be lost forever sitting in Eretz Geshur. Now, I have no doubt, I can't prove it, pure conjecture, but I have no doubt in my mind. Yoav had nothing to do with this argument. Because the last thing in the world that Yoav's frame of reference would put in the context of Yoav would be to worry about Avshalom's spiritual integrity. Is Avshalom getting kosher food? Is Avshalom going to marry a Jewish girl? Is Avshalom going to find a shul? Is Avshalom going to have Jewish children and grandchildren? Yoav doesn't talk in that language. David does. Yoav had nothing to do with this part of the conversation. But this is the part of the conversation, I think, that highlights why Tanakh describes her as Isha Chachama. What she says in those two sentences is all she needs to say. That's what resonates with David, to the point where David is completely convinced Avshalom needs to come back from Eretz Geshur. Now, does that mean that Avshalom gets to sit on the throne of Israel? Does that mean that Avshalom gets a political pardon? Or does that mean that Avshalom gets to come back and give him an embrace and a kiss? No. All it means is that we're going to find some other form of exile for Avshalom somewhere in Yerushalayim, somewhere in the Eretz Miklat, somewhere in Israel, but not in Eretz Geshur. We've got to pull Avshalom out from Eretz Geshur. Now, if he sends him a letter and he says, "My dear Avshalom, why don't you come home so that you can be banished in exile here in Yerushalayim?" Guarantee you, he's not coming. So he turns to Yoav and he says, "Yoav, what a wonderful idea. Bring Avshalom home. That's great." Avshalom is so pleased with himself. And then David says, "Okay, bring him back." He goes and tells Avshalom, "Avshalom, your father is going to bring you home. He's going to give you a royal pardon and welcome you back into the palace." Avshalom walks back into Yerushalayim, and David says he's never stepped in front of the palace. Let him go be banished at home. The issue isn't a pardon. The issue is to pull him out from the grasp of Melech Geshur. Levilti idach mimenu nidach. That's what she says to David. That's what David hears. That's what David does. And none of that has anything to do with Yoav. Yoav is David's puppet. Yoav goes and he brings him back. But Yoav is not part of that plan. But that's only half the picture. Why is it only half the picture? Because Yoav put her up to it. So what was Yoav's plan? Well, Yoav's plan had something to do with what happens in the next three psukim. Whatever it is, the next three psukim, that I believe is where Yoav's role in the story comes. And that's what we're going to explore next week. So at the end of the day, what I'm suggesting is that there are really two messages coming across to David in her speech. One's a language that's hidden and that is coded, that only David hears. And that's the reference to Avshalom as banished or exiled. David lived through that experience. David knows what it means to be exiled. David knows what it means to be banished. David knows what it means to live in Eretz Geshur. David hears it, and that's a piece with all of the intensity around what it means to live in foreign land when you're the only Jew in the exile from the country, etc. All of that resonates with David. Avshalom has to be plucked from the grasp of Melech Geshur. There's a second message, and that second message has to do with Yoav, and has to do with the kingship, and has to do with Avshalom, and that's the second message that we'll talk about next week, that the king also heard. Or at least he heard it articulated, but that he didn't agree with. So one message he accepts, the other message he rejects, and that's part of the dynamic with Yoav. That is what the Shem will get to next week. Okay, I've done enough talking for laryngitis. I'm going to stop here, and I will...
I have a question.
Yes, please.
You said there were Eri Miklat at that time, so why did Avshalom not go there? Just because he wanted to go to his grandfather's
house? Why should he go there? He's just committed genocide and regicide.
But he would have been safe there.
Fratricide and regicide, right? What?
Would he not have been safe there?
The issue isn't safe. From Avshalom's perspective, he runs to the safest place on the planet. To the opening embrace of his grandfather.
Maybe the Eri Miklat is just for someone who doesn't have anywhere else to go.
I have no doubt that he could have gone to an Eri Miklat, but why would he? Why would he? Avshalom doesn't come back to Yerushalayim to go into exile. Avshalom comes back to Yerushalayim to sit on the throne. What happens to Avshalom when he's sitting there for 2 years that he's sitting there in under house arrest? I think he takes it and says, "Oh, I understand. My father didn't want me back. He wanted me back, but he didn't want to. You know, I still have to pay my. I have to serve my term." No. He says to Yoav, he says, "Why did you bring me back if you didn't want me to come to the palace? Why did my father bring me back if he doesn't want me to come to the palace?" And that's precisely the issue. Avshalom went to Geshur because at that time, that was his only option. He only comes back because he thinks he's going to be embraced back. He's going to get a pardon and embraced back in the palace. David outwits him. And that's part of what we need to remember. David here is outwitting them all. Okay, he outplays Yoav and he outplays Avshalom. That's also something we need to remember. And David's not done. Okay, any other questions?
If he's so smart, though, then why didn't he think of the fact that that Avshalom was actually banished?
It's about being smart. I think it's about facing it in an emotional conversation. To bring back Avshalom is fraught with danger. As I said at the beginning of the outset of this year, not such a simple thing to pardon somebody who is guilty of treason. It takes a very subtle, nuanced kind of split the hair. Everybody thinks you're going to find like that. That's the circumstances that eventually arise. David is also embraced in the mourning and the emotion of it and the tragedy of it. Not so clear that he's thinking that in those terms until she presents it to him. That's exactly what she says to him. All right. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
And we will see you, B'shat Hashem, next week.
All right. Good night, everyone.